Let's come back to the end of last week's presentation and dovetail it with the beginning of this week's presentation. We closed out, and what was being presented was that there is a very special relationship between carrier wave major persons and the carrier wave 4,000 years ago was the first that was extraordinarily powerful in its ability to express a pair of extraordinary gifts. And that was 2000 BC. We're looking at the way in which language generates and evolves civilization, and that the ability to have a written language imposed on the few who became literate in that sense of being able to initially read and write had an extraordinarily speeded up and expanded access to vision. In Neolithic times, there was an improvement over the old Paleolithic. In order to have a vision, in Paleolithic times, the tendency was to go underground into caves and to have a series of initiatory stages that one went through deep underground so that you would be able to put these images and these experiences in the context of a hidden landscape, not of this regular world, but of an extraordinary nether world. And so the earliest art in the world was associated some 40,000 years ago with initiations in caves. Those initiations were mystically visible, and there probably was a minimum of language involved. In the Neolithic, there was an above ground transforming of this world, of being able to, I think the polite word is tame, to begin to know how to tame the plants, how to tame the animals, tame the minerals, tame the metals, beginning to tame ourselves. In the sense that agriculture and animal husbandry and metallurgy and mineralogy and the beginnings of a much more advanced culture came to the fore. In that, eventually, there came to be more permanent places of human habitation that eventually, as early as 6500 BC, 8,500 years ago, you had the beginnings of cities that, like Kartli-Hulyuk in central what is now Turkey, Anatolia, you had communities that were large enough to be called cities. And out of that came a proto-civilization for about 3,000 years until the development out of the proto-civilization where there was numeracy, where one could learn to express by signs, by representative images, by counting, to be able to communicate enough to have a commerce of cultures that were in cities. And so we tended to think that civilization was due to cities. It is due to language. Language is the carrier, and in several major stages, it has brought us to where we are at the beginnings of a completely new carrier wave time form. Because in the proto-civilization, culture became more and more dependent upon the complexity of life, no longer just tribal, no longer just small groups of family-related persons, but about 4,350 BC, the beginnings of a true literate language began to come into play, and it took about 300 some years for there to be enough experience with that, that increased and expanded, that sped up access to vision, no longer limited to an underground netherworld initiatory experience, and no longer just responsive to the way in which one has the taming of plants and animals, minerals, metals, and ourselves in above ground agricultural related, animal husbandry related, early metallurgical related, early mineralogy related, early sociological qualities. And that first generation became mythically Adam and Eve about 4,000 BC. The myth is that they were exiled from Eden because Eden was the natural context in which the culture was still proto, was still involved. But they had eaten, mythically, of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that there was such a thing as a negative vision, and there is such a thing as a positive vision. And so one began to understand that you have to be cautious about entering into vision, and you have to prepare yourself to do so by going through the cycle of the seasons in a conscientious way. And so the urban written language expression of culture began to keep track of a calendar year, of a festival calendar year, which was not just tied to the animals or the plants or the human commerce, but respected that there was an increased access to vision. And in doing so, one needed to have the assurance that there were visionary helpers who would help guide this access to the pace of the seasons, and that the pace of the seasons was not just something natural, but was festival as well, and that the festivals became actually ceremonial on a very large scale. The Garden of Eden was the au naturel state, and the quote expulsion, the leaving of it, was understanding that one had come into a more complex world, and that written language was more dynamic than the natural seasons. 2,000 years after Adam and Eve comes Abraham, and he's born about 2,000 BC, But at age 75, he had an enormous vision of a promised land that he must go to. He must take his wife, his half-sister, Sarai, who later, when she would have their son, she became Sarah, and his nephew, Lot, and his wife, and their servants, and their animals, and they left what was now northern Iraq, Haran, and went to the Mediterranean coast, what was then ancient Canaan, which was the Phoenician cousins, as it were. And after about 75 years, when they got there, it took a while for Abraham to understand that something enormous had happened, that the promised land was needed to be inhabited in a very courageous way. Exactly at the same time, born about 2000 BC, from a northern Central Asia long caravan route was Zarathustra. Zarathustra, meaning good with camels, Spitama was the family name. And when Zarathustra was 75, he had the vision to write what became his Gathas. And I have made a translation over 10, 15 years from the ancient Avestic. And the Avesta is a written language from Central Asia, whereas the written language from Phoenicia is of a Semitic nature. The word in Avestan for nobility, that is, those who could read and write and whose spiritual vision was a normal part of how they comported in the world. And in Avestan, noble is Arya, out of which we would get the English word, the Indo-European word, Aryan. So that the Semitic and the Aryan heritages ran a parallel, and they were tuned. And the tuning of them could be put into an encapsulation of Zarathustra and Abraham, and that the relationship between them is that the Semitic Abraham were long caravan routes that would be taken in the daytime, whereas the Central Asian, because they dealt with vast, huge, desolate plateaus, their caravans ran in the night, so that they would steer by star constellations, whereas the Semitic would steer by the sun and the moon, and occasionally one would put in there the planet Venus, which has an eight-year cycle, the morning and the evening star. So that you have, eventually, when they're put back into a time evolution, by the time there was a renaissance of both those carrier waves, about 1,500 years into a 2,000-year cycle, that renaissance brought Zarathustra back as Zoroaster, stargazer, and brought the Semitic back as Ezekiel. And that renaissance happened to overlap, and the overlapping was the Persian Empire founded by Cyrus the Great. And into that empire came the most prominent of the classical Greek thinkers, Pythagoras. It's interesting to see that Pythagoras was part ancient Greek and part Phoenician. His father, Menasarchus, ran a huge shipping trading concern out of Tyre on the coast of Phoenicia. His mother was a high priestess for the great mystical island Samothrace for the great gods. And the great gods there were the netherworld ancient ones, Persephone and Hades or Pluto, and the upper ones, which were Aphrodite and Hermes, and the two sons of theirs, who were twins, and in mythic terminology, they're called the Dioscuri in Greek, the twins. So that you had on Samothrace a very interesting kind of environment. It's like an enormous ridge of mountains that just leap out of the northern Aegean to such a great height that from the top of the highest mountain, one can look across the northern Aegean and see the coastline of distant Thrace and look to the east and see the distant coastline where Troy used to be on the mainland of Anatolia. And one could look down to the south and begin to see the amazing stepping stones of the Aegean major islands like Lesbos and then Chios and then Samos, where Pythagoras was supposed to have spent his early life. But his mother, being the high priestess at Samothrace, when she was engaged to marry Menasarchus, she was a visionary of the highest order. And so she took them for their marriage ceremony to Delphi, because Delphi is related to Samothrace, and it's related to Samothrace through Eleusis. The Eleusinian mysteries are largely of the relationship of Demeter to Persephone with a masculine outrigger named Triptolemus, who was the embodiment of the man who had studied the taming of wild grasses, goat grasses, to run it through two different transformations. One to make a kind of expanse of the grain heads of the wild grass into emmer by doubling the number of little grains and then doubling it again through a second to a third stage where you finally had bread wheat, where there were 8 kernels to the wild grass and emmer had 16 grains. The wild bread transformed twice to the bread wheat, the third stage, had 32 heads. So that you had the ability to have a crop, to have enough grain that you could store it, and you could feed a very large comparative population for the whole year. And so the bread wheat, if you ever get a chance to have a dried bread wheat, you'll see something interesting to it. The heads of the grain are so large, so many, so packed, that it cannot seed itself except just to drop the grains on the ground right where it is, and you don't get a crop. You just get a bunch of competing grains. So bread wheat has to be sown by hand, sowing the oats. And so the whole thing about the fertility of civilized, complex life is that one has to not sow wild oats, but double transformed oats. You have to go through a transformation out of the wild to the tamed, and then out of the tamed to the noble. And once one receives this third level, one is able then to understand that you can go back and recover a high-powered, visionary experience out of the wild again, because you're not just returning to it in a cycle, but you're returning to it prepared, to be prepared to experience it all. And so at Delphi, the experience was that the mystical language from the deep cleft in the earth at Delphi did not come in a language that man could hear, but came in a language that only a visionary young woman, an older girl, a young woman, would be able to speak it. And what she spoke was in such a high poetic that it came out to men as if it were like riddles, which then would have to be interpreted, and it would take a long time sometimes to interpret. Whereas when the high priestess, the mother of Pythagoras, conceived Pythagoras at Delphi, she was able to hear exactly who this was and named him for the Pythian Apollo of Delphi, Pythagoras, and changed her name to Pythias. And when he grew up in one of the most peculiar childhoods ever lived by a person up to that time. His father discovered an orphan in the wild under a tree looking up at the noonday sun without having to look away and without blinking his eyes. And he had this milky white skin. And so he adopted this baby. And this baby had very peculiar genetic makeup. Obviously was a star child, was not human, was humanistic, but not of our world. And so Pythagoras grew up with a mother who schooled him to have almost a feminine openness to the mysteries of life, and the father that there are really extraordinary things going on vis-a-vis the higher levels of man. And Pythagoras growing up watching how this half-brother, this strange person would move and have gestures that were extraordinary. And so he grew up to be enormously sensitive and was sent to Egypt to the great Heliopolis area for about 22 years where he studied there. But Egypt at that time was under the control of the inheritors of Cyrus the Great. So it was under Persian control. And so it was very easy for Pythagoras after 22 years with the Egyptian mysteries to go to Persia, where he spent 11 years, just exactly at the time that Cyrus the Great, who had released the jeweled helpers of the Persian Empire, which had conquered the Babylonian Empire. And so the Jews were allowed to go home. They were not slaves there. They were the ones who ran the great international trading business of the Persian Empire, which spread from India to the Aegean. And none of the native Persian tribal people had the acumen to be able to keep these very large trade routes viable. The Jews had it because the first great trade routes from the Aegean to India were founded by Sargon of Akkad about 2350 BC, which means that Sargon was a 2,000-year period after the development of a written language in the Northern Semitic, and that Abraham came into Phoenicia about the time that the Northern Semitic Southern written alphabet had come into play. And you had the development then of a written Phoenician that 1,000 years later would have a tuned split of new classical written languages. One was Hebrew and the other was classical Greek. So that you had Homer being able to write down his great epics and his hymns to some of the gods like Apollo and Hermes. And at the same time, you had the northern area written language that Zarathustra was the real founder of, about 1925 BC. So that here's a translation of just 6 lines of Zarathustra. And in this, he's going to talk and express one of the 6 spirit helpers is Asha, feminine, who is masterful at helping us, guiding us to have order in our lives. The order of the taming of plants and animals, the order of taming minerals and metals, the taming of ourselves, so that what comes out of it is Vohuman, the helper of the good mind, so that there's a masculine and a feminine that tie a bow together. And the 6 Amesha Spentas, the 6 spirit helpers, are paired, male and female, masculine and feminine. And the feminine ones always begin with A, Ah. There's Asha, order, good order. There's Armeti, love, real love. And then there's Ameritat, which is, she's the helper for eternal health. And she always is tuned to her twin, Harvratat, who is the masculine of good health in our life, whereas Ameritat is eternal good health. And so they're related. They're tied together. So there are 3 bows of 3 sets, 3 levels, and you see the beginnings of a very esoteric quality in the universe. A lot of the energy is generated by electrons. It's called electronics. And there are 3 different kinds of electrons. Electrons, and when they're more powerful, they're muons. And when they're really super powerful, they're tau particles. And so you get this triple quality that's there throughout all of civilization, becoming more and more as spiraling evolutions take place. And not just a spiral, but a complementarity of 2 spirals that play together. And as they do, the expansion more and more shows, discloses, plays out as a more and more complex rhythm and repose of 3 braided time forms. There's a masculine time form that is chiral in a certain way. There's a feminine time form that's chiral in a complementary way. And one finds about 2500 BC, something which had been for almost 700 years, the ability to see that if you keep track of the sun and the moon and Venus, and you also keep track of the way in which your appreciation of it begins to have this double spiraling, you begin to get the sophistication that there is something major to be recognized on a vast scalar, and that scalar eventually becomes a spectrum. And the earliest spectrum symbol is the rainbow. We now have computer rainbows of millions of colors. And so we have a great responsibility on ourselves. If we want to become real, we have to really be real on a vast, huge scalar, a spectrum that would frighten people even of 100 years ago. Here are the lines. Mantra in this is mantra. The Avestan is mantra. And there is a word in here of Shraosha. And just let it be that that name is going to be in here. Here's Zarathustra, 4,000 years ago. Asha, when I see you in mind and good wisdom, guided by Ahura's almighty Shraosha, brilliance realized with this mantra, the brightest convert, ignorance purified with language. And so the ability to understand that the poetic purifies a language which could have stayed frozen in just conducting business on kind of a low level of communication, or just tending maybe on a higher level, but still rather pedestrian, on tending plants and animals and rocks and metals, but a poetic is an art of speaking and reading and writing. And in a poetic, the mantra or the mantra quality is the carrier wave coming through the ability to express on a higher and higher potent energy level, so that 1,000 years after Abraham comes King David, who for the first time is furnished with a new, refined, fresh, great language, Hebrew, and he is able to write his Psalms. And so David's Psalms are a interesting quality because it is on the level of Zarathustra's Gathas. David's Psalms are really something. And not only that, but he was like the pioneering millennial visionary between, he was about 1350 BC, so he came a millennium after the great Sargon of Akkad at 2350 BC, and he came a millennium before 350 BC, which is Alexander the Great. So that the mosaic balances between Sargon and Alexander the Great, but the carrier wave is in between Zarathustra and Abraham and what would come 1,000 years after King David, Jesus, and Mary Magdalene. So that you get this enormous play in civilization of dynamics that begin to bring us out so that more and more we have the ability to have a very high poetic 2,000 years ago. And when we come back from the break, I will read one of the great odes of Mary Magdalene. And it has that quality, unmistakable, that David's Psalms have, that Zarathustra's gathas have. But in order to appreciate, we have to go to where there was a meeting of the Semitic and the Arya, and the easiest way to understand their meeting in a tuned way is to find that they met in India. And in India, if you're acquainted with Indian civilization, reveals, like almost no other place reveals, the tunable, overlapping, crisscrossing, the bringing together of two hands, two poetics that express themselves increasingly with such clarity that Indian literature contains one of the greatest documents in the world, contains the Bhagavad Gita. And in the Bhagavad Gita, Gita is Sanskrit for gatha. It's an extension where the mantra, the mantra, is extended to gothic harmonic. And in the Bhagavad Gita, in our time, in the 20th century, leading into the 21st century, the Gita became the fulcrum of one of the greatest developments in world civilization. And when we come back, we'll take a look at one of the great bodhisattvas of the 20th century and the early 21st century. And we will take a look at Vimla Thakkar, who is not only an inheritor of Gandhi and Vinoba, but also of Krishnamurti. And she is really something. The cover of her book, Life as Yoga, has a mystical drawing, and you each have a sheet of this, and later we'll put it by the cameras so that you can see. And her volume, Life as Yoga, is extraordinary. The emphasis is a way out of competition, both in its violence and in its legalism, into a third power, and she calls it blossoms of friendship. There is such a thing as opposites not only attracting, but enjoying each other as friends. Let's take a break. Let's come back to Zarathustra and dwell for just a moment on the word Sraosha, and then we'll have an ode from Mary Magdalene's Odes to Solomon. They're related. Asha, when I see you in mind and good wisdom, guided by Ahuras, Almighty Sraosha, brilliance realized, with this mantra the brightest, convert, ignorance purified with language. Now there's only one book on Sraosha in the world, published in Leiden, the Netherlands, but this was the footnote that I put into my translation, which encapsulates that. Sraosha is the proper name of the divine spirit derived from the real verb meaning to hear. Sraosha is masculine and is associated with the verb to be obedient. This connotates dedication, he who hearkens to God's purpose. He hearkens also to man's prayers in mantra form, so that mantra and divinity are a pair for Sraosha, the hearkener, whose alert attention joins God and man into a continuity of shared presence purpose. This is the writer's original poetic. 2,000 years later, this ode from Mary Magdalene. The dove fluttered over the head of our Lord, Messiah, because he was her head. And she sang over him, and her voice was heard. Then the inhabitants were afraid, and the foreigners were disturbed. The bird began to fly, and every creeping thing died in its hole, and the chasms were opened and closed. And they were seeking the Lord as those who are about to give birth, because he was not given to them for nourishment, because he did not belong to them. But the chasms were submerged in the submission of the Lord, and they perished in that device with which they had remained from the beginning. For they travailed from the beginning, and the end of their travail was life. And all of them who were lacking perished, because they were not able to express the word so that they might remain. And the Lord destroyed the devices of all those who had not the truth with them. For they were lacking in wisdom, they who exalted themselves in their mind. So they were rejected, because the truth was not with them. For the Lord revealed his way and spread widely his grace, and those who understood it knew his holiness. Hallelujah. When you move in millennial cadence, you begin to get the understanding, but you have to go to the paired double millennium, the aeon, in order to find the cadence of immense spiral. Yeats called them gyres. They're spirit dimension. They're differential conscious dimensions that are now curling what used to be just cycles of nature into the spring of emergence on grander and grander scales. We're looking at the way in which a three-pronged movement centered in Alexandria towards the end of the first century AD, at the same concomitant time in the India of that same era, the birth of the Mahayana, and at the very same time in the far west surrounding the Irish Sea, you had the beginnings of a mystical quest that 500 years later would be the beginnings of the great Arthurian foundations. This is from the early, very early Mahayana in India. The large sutra is called the Astasahasrika Sutra, and the poetic form, the mantra form of it, we have looked at for several presentations, is the Prajna Paramita Ratna Guna Samkhya Gatha. This is from the end of the Astasahasrika Sutra, and it's about a smile of recognition. One usually doesn't think of the Buddha smiling. This is how it reads in a beautiful English translation. It's not very long. There was a woman who had come to the assembly and sat down. She rose from her seat, adjusted her top robe over one shoulder, and knelt to the earth on her right knee, folded her hands toward the Lord Buddha and said to him, Lord Buddha, in this place, I am not frightened. I am not terrified, not trembling, not frightened and not terrified. I will show the teachings to all sentient beings. Then the Lord Buddha broke into a smile, golden in color, on that occasion. By its luster, it beamed through endless and boundless world systems, rising up as far as Brahma's world. Then, after it returned, it circled around Lord Buddha three times and then finally faded from his face. Immediately after the Lord Buddha had broken into that smile, the woman seized some golden flowers, strewing and scattering the golden flowers over the Lord Buddha, but then those golden flowers, unsupported, were suspended in the air. Zero gravity. Then the Venerable Ananda arose from his seat, adjusted his top robe over one shoulder, knelt to the earth on his right knee, folded his hands towards the Lord Buddha, and said to him, "What prompted that, Lord Buddha? What was the reason you broke into a smile? Truly perfectedly enlightened Tathagatas and Arhats do not break into a smile without good cause or good reason." So then the Lord Buddha replied to the Venerable Ananda, "Ananda, this is our sister, the goddess of the Ganges. In a future time, she will be the Tathagata called Golden Flower. She will arise as an arhat, truly perfectly enlightened, accomplished in knowledge and good conduct, a sugata, streetwise, supreme, a tamer of wild men and a teacher of both gods and men, a Buddha, a Lord Buddha. She will become completely enlightened in supreme, truly perfect enlightenment in the stellar aeon," which is where we are. The qualities that we're looking at is that 2,000 years ago, about 1900 years ago, to be precise, there, in fact, it's 2,000 years after Abraham arriving at the Promised Land and Zarathustra writing the Gathas, we're right there at that particular carrier wave, and we need to understand that that 2,000-year period not only is in terms of a carrier wave, but at the same time, in terms of the reference wave. We talked about how there is from 1350 BC Moses to 350 BC Alexander the Great. And if you go a millennium after Alexander the Great, you come to 650 AD, and that is Muhammad. So that Muhammad is an aeonic carrier wave of Moses. So the whole thing about Islam and Judaism being at odds with each other is a completely ignorant fiction. That Iran and Israel should be on the brink of nuclear war is a nightmare of stupidity, of not understanding civilization, not understanding time forms, not understanding waves and wave theory, because there has been no pilot wave able to bring this out. And that's why the pilot waves are extremely important. And the founding of pilot waves was by Prince de Broglie, and in this University of Cambridge Press, redoing the 1927 Solvay conference that we have repeatedly now shown. The major part of that conference and this volume is de Broglie's pilot waves. What happened was that the ability to understand a very high, complex physics became more and more complex in terms of its mathematics in the late 1930s. And a lot of what de Broglie's pilot wave vision and theory lapsed simply because there were fewer and fewer people able to then expand it and put it into this huge complexity. And so it faded, fell by the wayside until 1952, and the great outlaw physicist David Bohm brought it back in a series of articles in the Physics Review, and they were put together with as causality and chance in modern physics, forward by Louis de Broglie. And the emphasis that Bohm put into this was that pilot waves carry and express the hidden attributes, not the phenomenal attributes, not the physical, but the hidden, in the sense that they would be undiscernible, they would be unexpressible. And one of the interesting things is that there was a collection of J.S. Bell's great publications, articles, Speakable and Unspeakable in Quantum Physics. Now, Cambridge is one of the great universities and publishers of the world, and they brought out two volumes that were put together in the late 1980s, 88, 89, Quantum Space and Time, The Quest Continues. It is a quest. Studies in the essay and essays in honor of Louis de Broglie, Paul Dirac, and Eugene Wigner. And starting next week, we will take a look a little bit more. But one thing is interesting for us, especially today. David Bohm found someone that he could speak to about the hidden attributes, and that person was Krishnamurti. And he and Krishnamurti began to understand that though neither could write it specifically, because it was not specifically writable, that a dialogue between them would be theatrical enough. Wallace Stevens used a great poetic phrase one time, theatrical amplitudes, where the sky and the ocean are seen to vanish together. And it's in that kind of a dialogue that Krishnamurti was able to bring out from David Bohm, beginning in the late 50s, early 1960s. And it was exactly at that time that our Bodhisattva of the week, Vimla Thakur, left off of the Gandhian Vinoba social work in India and began to journey to Holland and to give talks and to become very close to Krishnamurti, and became able finally to write something which I think deserves a little bit of reading. This is from her collected volume, Life is Yoga. There are 13 talks from the early 1970s, 71, 72, and brought together. And this is some of her tone. And this is how a 20th century, early 21st century. She lived to be almost 88. She was born April 15th, 1921, and she died March 11th, 88 years later in the 21st century. So very few people have understood Gandhi, she says. In India, the dearness suffix is G, so Gandhiji. All who thronged around Gandhiji, did they understand what he said? Very few indeed understood him. But they were people hungry for friendship and love, people charmed by a single smile of his, people whose lives were transformed by a single word of his. So I am talking to you about the scientific basis of what happened. If you do not understand the scientific meaning of these happenings, they will not be sources of inspiration. They will not be weapons and instruments which would bring about a revolution in your life. So come and meet us on the level of friendship. In other words, you should be fully assured, as far as I am concerned, that there is going to be no exploitation by me. You should feel that this sister of yours has no axes to grind, no mission of her own, no organization, no institution to build up. Only then will you be able to approach me without a purpose. You should feel that there is nothing which I expect from you, nothing except friendship. If you have this assurance, you will have no fears. There is one more assurance, that I have no desire to change you. If a change takes place, of course I shall be happy. And so she would speak in this way for maybe 70 years of her life. She eventually showed that there needs to be a balance with the development of our higher dimensional person and the social evolution of the distribution of the cooperation of such persons through the whole immersion of what is going on in terms of life. Not just the civilized portion of life, but this affects also the plants, the animals, the metals, the minerals, the higher dimensions. One of Vinoba's collections of presentations was called Third Power, A New Dimension, where he says, we are caught between the violent forces of military and the complex, increasingly structures of legalism and laws. And so in between laws and wars, our ability to live is being clasped further and further into a swing, a manic swing between these two competing demonics. And the third power is to begin to dissolve their ability to inhabit the landscapes of life, so that when they begin to fade like a fog, they will rise above the ground. There was a great Japanese printmaker whose father was the greatest Japanese printmaker of the 20th century, Hiroki Yoshida. His talented son was Toshi Yoshida. And I saw one of his prints one time that had the Sanskrit word in letters raised above the forested ground, and the word that was up there was illusion, which was evaporating as one took a look, that more and more the landscape began to emerge as the actuality. And it was just like a steam or smoke that the Sanskrit words of a very light cinnamon seemed to be able to blend almost into the atmosphere of clouds and blue. More next week.